Blog Talk Radio.
It's gonna be some stuff you're gonna see that's gonna make it hard to smile in the future. But through whatever you see, through all the rain and the pain, you gotta keep your sense of humor. You gotta be able to smile through all this bullshit. Everything has changed. Everything has stayed the same. You've heard this rhetoric from me before, so I'll wait a little longer before I get into it. I have a couple of guests tonight. My first guest really inspired me to pick this particular title because he is also talking about leadership. And leadership is one of the things that we seem to be missing today. And when I say missing, I mean that from the highest position in the land, meaning 45, to his cronies, Mitch McConnell, Lindsey Graham, a few others. You all know who you are. The governor of Florida, the governor of Texas, the governor of Georgia. Yes, and even the Dakotas. So we're in a land of division here, and those of you some of you are probably not my age, but some of you have probably heard from your grandfathers, grandmothers, or whatever, the fish rots from the head down. And this has been especially true in the last 3.5 years. So I'm going to bring my first guest on, and he wrote a very interesting on Next
Hello?
Door. Hello, sir. How are you doing this evening?
I'm doing mighty fine. How are you?
I'm doing fine. This is James. I'm calling from the Political Consciousness, West Coast Steelers fan.
I love it.
And we had a little discussion today about your post, but I didn't really want to get into a lot of it, and I really didn't introduce your name, even though I'm sure those of us that are in the same neighborhood know who you are. But tell us a little bit about yourself, if you want to include your name, fine. If you want to remain anonymous, that's fine.
Give a first name is always good. I do love my name. It was given to me by my loving parents. My name is Andy. I moved to San Diego just about 4 months ago and joined the Nextdoor app for the first time, actually. So I'm still learning about it a lot. Background, from the Midwest, went to Northern Arizona University to get a bachelor's in science of education. I've taught for 2+ years in a few different settings. I teach through a lens of critical social education, which draws young people into an understanding of the complexities of their social world and develops the knowledge, skills, and dispositions necessary to analyze and, if desired, change their world. So when I go about my life, I'm also looking at the complexities of the world and how I can cope with them, or if they're not acceptable, change them. Additionally to my teaching, I like to mention that I've been a camp counselor, sports coach, volunteer, or teacher since I was 16 years old. And I know 10 years of experience isn't the most, but it's not none, and it's not a small amount. So I definitely have some expertise in the education field. I grew up in a very wealthy suburban neighborhood. My camp counselor said that I lived in a bubble. And as a kid, I didn't even know what that meant because I was in that bubble. It was absolutely true. And then a couple things I remembered. No one ever told me, hey, the Civil War wasn't actually about ending slavery until eighth grade. And no one told me that, like, Columbus and all his business was bad in America, its founding. I didn't realize all that miserable history until freshman year of college. So finally I was able to pop my bubble and, you know, become woke, or, you know, get on the path to wokeness, if you will. I still have a lot of learning to do. Go ahead.
You mentioned the fact that you lived in a bubble, and I've somewhat come from that background. In my junior high year, I kind of moved to a rural area. But not only did my junior high serve the rural area, but we also served a couple of the well-to-do suburbs around town. So we definitely had two different dichotomies going on here, where you had the bubble like you lived in, and then we had, the kids that went home, and then, we had to get the free lunches and things like that. But it does seem to me that a lot of people, they grew up in that bubble. Even after reading history and after going through our great ups and downs as a country, it seems that people are afraid to accept history, or at least they're more likely to accept their own version of history. Did you find that, and how hard was it to penetrate that bubble where you were able to accept things outside your bubble?
Yeah, definitely. I think the word systemic is going to start to pop up. When you get outside of your bubble, you experience people of different socioeconomic status, different religion, different color, and you find that your beliefs are not their beliefs sometimes, but you find sometimes you like these people and you want to spend your time with them, and you find ways to, understand each other. And then when you kind of, when you're when you're in a bubble, and then you'll do some things that you're ashamed of. I posted on Nextdoor that one time I'm so ashamed. I hate to say this publicly, but I will, because I've learned from it.
at a high school football game, I painted my entire body black, including my face. And I had absolutely no idea that would be offensive. But now when I, you know, have come to learn and become educated and someone said, hey, did you know that this is a thing? I was like, whoa, the system that said, hey, just wear all black to the football game, it's cool. And that's, you know, very Western, very high school, college kind of camaraderie. I didn't realize within there that because of living in that bubble that I was doing something wrong. So your question was, how do people explain their own behavior, decide to change their behavior? I think it comes through education. But when are people willing to be educated is a important question. Most old people think, well, I'm past college. I have all I need. Not most people. That was mean. Not most old people. There's a group of people who are, you know, 40, 50, 60, kind of, I feel like, are set in their ways. They are, you know, I learned it this way, I do it this way, even if it has essence of systemic racism, you know, because my dad did it. And that's just, it's really sad and hard to wrap my head around, because I just want everyone to love and be free and peaceful. And then when there's someone who gets in that way, it's like, why? You know, someone was offended. Say you're sorry and don't do it again. It's as simple as that, but people take it's pride. And I have a lot of pride too. That's why, like I said, it was hard to admit that I'd done something horrible. But I think people are more willing to give you respect if you are willing to, this is just so obvious. People are more willing to give you respect if you make a mistake and admit to it and eat crow than if you are to stick in your ways and be stubborn. Even if you are right 9 times out of 10, if you're in a situation where that one time calls for you to adjust your behavior, adjust your behavior.
I have a little problem with what you're saying there, because I kind of fall into that group that you were talking about. In fact, I'm a little older because I'm in my 70s.
But, oh, I didn't mean to, but explain. Go ahead.
No. The reason why I'm saying this is because when you think of, you know, like things that a guy my age has gone through when you go through political correctness. For instance, when I was in high school, you know, it was all right to call gay people fags, and you know, I mean, you know, there was no LGBTQ community. You know, you either queer or you were a fag or so forth and so on. The N-word
if you don't mind me jumping in, once you were educated on what fag meant, and a like flaming faggot, which meant to burn a gay person, you know, above a pile of sticks, did you then maybe not, did you not use that word afterwards?
Oh, I haven't used the word in years, but what I'm saying exactly is, what I'm saying is, I'm kind of referring back to what you say. It's like, you know, well, my grandfather did it, you know, and you know, my father's father did it, you know. Well,
sure.
My point is, you know, like even with opening up a show like this, there were certain things that I had to get out of my mind. I had to modernize. In other words, I had to improvise. I had to improve with the times. So it was either catch up or get run over. And I kind of feel like that's where we are in our country today. And as an educator, do you find it harder to go through as many different levels of subconsciousness in a high school setting, well, in a classroom setting, than you did as a student before you went to college?
Yeah, absolutely. Again, when I was a student, I was kind of oblivious. I just kind of did what I was told and did what I wanted. And then as a teacher, you have to guide without being biased. So, you know, the thing to say to students is, when you are 18, you should vote. But you don't want to say to a student, don't vote for this person, or do vote for this person, because that's not letting them understand the complexities of their own life. You're giving them the answers, and your answer is not their answer. So, and again, I taught special education classes, so I only had about 12 or less students, which was very nice, in my classroom at a time. But it was another thing that's hard to manage, especially in that setting, is when you have a very outspoken student. I remember I had a student who was a very big Trump supporter, and he was also the student who I had a hard time getting to raise his hand before talking in, you know, in that setting. And he was very vocal and very passionate about his beliefs. And it was funny, his reasoning always came back to, well, my dad said, da 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 da. And I just,
right.
Like, I didn't say this to him because it's not my place, but I wanted to say, well, you know, why is your dad saying that? Where is he coming from? And do you believe this? Because, oh man, this student, he was an amazing kid. He would come to me and say, I believe in rights for people with disabilities. I believe in rights for I believe all people of LGBTQ should be treated equally. But, and then he would say, but I don't know about the military issue or I had a hard time helping him understand the All Lives Matter rhetoric of how that is not how that is a racist term. And you know, you want to tell someone, of course you matter. No one's saying you don't matter. I'm here, I'm teaching you. I wouldn't be here if you didn't matter. You wouldn't be here if you didn't matter. But right now the issue is we have to focus on the main issue, the big issue, the issue, and not, you know, whether you're going to get better pizza in the food line.
What about curriculum? There are a lot of things that I learned in
mm-hmm.
my high school that are no longer taught. And some of those things that were taught, now you do have to wait until you get to college in order for you to learn. Some, you know, some things we were taught as seniors, especially if you were going to take SATs or you were expecting to go on to college, that you had to do some research and you had to do some looking into. Do you find
Absolutely.
That even though your students may be open to certain ideas and suggestions, you have some kickback from the parents? You know, I mean, for instance, you wanted one of your kids to write a paper on why we should take down Confederate statues, just as an argument, not necessarily as, you know, but as a debate, you know, one affirmative, one negative. Do you find that it's harder for you to get through to the parents, or do you find that it's harder for you to, how do you as a teacher shape the education of our youth, you know, without stepping on toes, I guess? That's
yeah.
The question.
I would say, you know, 90-95% of the time, it's almost a non-issue because parents trust the administration to hire good teachers who are qualified and want the best for their students. There's nobody in a school building that doesn't worry about the safety and well-being of the student first. I'm not saying there's not bad teachers. I'm just saying at least everybody's on board with that, which is good. However, in that 5-10% of the times is when you do have to walk on eggshells and be very delicate as to not offend a parent with a particular view or viewpoint. The issue of the gender binary is a pretty popular one in school. Students identifying not as male or female, but as gender neutral or agender or non-binary. And again, kind of what I said before, if somebody wants to do something, let them go and do it. Like, why get in the way and create negativity from nothing? And so when parents find out this information, if they're against it, you're lucky if they come to you first, because if they go to the administration, you just get a meeting with your supervisor. Mostly the issues that I ran into were with parents who were, or teachers even, who were very religious, or military parents who didn't want issues of LGBTQ being discussed in class. Did that answer your question?
Yeah. So did you find that also on a religious basis or just a military basis? I'm just kind of wondering here, because I've asked people about don't ask, don't tell. And, you know, it does seem like, it almost seems like, you know, even though we're supposed to be in this politically and enlightened age, we're still in the age of don't ask, don't tell. I kind of figure this is what leadership is doing within the different groups, LGBTQ, for instance, Black Lives Matter, you know, the different organizations like that. And you always try to find someone to tear down their credibility, but when you talk about someone like what is it, the Proud Boys and a few other organizations, well, that's all right because they're just protecting their rights. How do you, you know, how do you reconcile these type of points when, you know, being a veteran, I can understand how you, you know, especially the modern type of veteran that's strictly volunteer. How do you reconcile that in a military town like San Diego, especially?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, if I had to take that question like to heart and personally, and think about how am I going to, like, you know, develop my career with that, I think it's finding the right school, the right fit. I'm huge into project-based learning, learning through experience as opposed to lecture and worksheets. And unfortunately, the public school system can't necessarily finance that or have that be aimed to help all the students who are there. That's why I do believe that charter and private schools should run effectively together. Charter, public, and private schools should all run effectively together to provide, well, not in private necessarily, but free and appropriate public education, FAPE, for students in the best setting possible. We don't have the money for that, but hey, if we defund the police, we could fund the teachers and the social workers.
Oh man, see, you're gonna make me bring you back on the show, man. We got a lot.
Oh, I don't know much about that,
but you do have a viewpoint, and that's what we need to discuss. We need to discuss viewpoints and how we're going to get things across. As I said, you were the inspiration for the title of my show tonight, When Leadership Rots, because you mentioned that you belong to a group or you know of a group that has a leader that you consider racist. And, I don't know exactly what your views are, but I consider our present leadership under 45 and Mitch McConnell and Lindsey Graham, I consider it pretty much the same thing. When the top is rotten, there's very little that you can do to save the body. But would you tell me a little bit about your situation?
Well, yeah. So I moved here about 4 months ago, 3-4 months ago, and I had never been on the app before. And my impression of the app was that it is, you know, a community-based information system. You know, you go on there to find out what's that loud noise coming from down the street, or, you know, God forbid, someone's car is broken into. maybe there's a chain of crime, people are able to put that together and help file a police report together. Lost dogs, community events, et cetera. And to see this individual, for clarification, the only requirement to become a community lead is that you have to invite enough people and those people have to join. So it's not like he had credentials or he applied to be a lead. He just became one after inviting so many people. To see racist rhetoric, this person has stated all lives matter. They deny systemic racism. They deny the fact that there's racial inequality in America. And then on top of that, he goes and calls people stupid and threatens for lawsuits over opinion, which is protected under the First Amendment. I feel like an elementary school teacher throwing out First Amendment. And so it's just really gross and really sad and disheartening that someone who is, I mean, it doesn't matter how old you are, but has had all this time on earth, maybe 50, 60 years, to understand that negativity and hatred and divisiveness and racism and white supremacy have no place anywhere.
I understand what you're saying, and I commend what you're saying, but you, once again, you're talking about people that are around my age or close to me, and we are actually on our way out. We need the voices of young people. We need the voices of people with independent thought. How do we engage your generation and the people that are actually going to be teaching the next generation on what it means to be an American and what that means? I mean, you know, to me, we've never stopped being great. I think we're the greatest country in the world. Now, we might have some people here that are not so great, but as far as overall, and then when you look at the world leaders, I think we've always been great.
Slam dunk. But I fucking love this country.
But I also think that we've also, like I said, we've adapted that kind of don't ask, don't tell. If things are going bad in your community, well, I don't want to know about that. Tell me what's happening over there in suburbia. Tell me, how my stocks are going. Don't tell me that, our schools are shutting down or that, we need a school levy. Or that we need extra money for the police we don't have a grocery store in our neighborhood. We don't have a community center in our neighborhood. How do you address those issues?
Man, that's really hard. I think.
Did I throw too much at you at one time?
No, I just don't think that. I mean, I don't think I'm the person to address these issues. I realize something I thought of as you were talking is that. I'm sorry.
It starts with you, though. It starts with that one person.
Of course.
Whoa.
What I was going to say is that what I noticed, what you were saying, is that we need to find a positive way for people to make their own opinions without forcing them into one. And kind of like what I was saying about how a teacher needs to encourage students to vote, not tell them which person to vote for. And yes, like you said, this is, if not like one of the greatest, if not the greatest country in the world. Like, we're so lucky to have the freedoms that we have and all the resources and natural resources and, like, again, I'm not like well versed in the law. I can't like go out and tell you all those things, but what I was going to say in response is the 13th Amendment is kind of where that issue began, where it says people are only free and a whole citizen unless they have been convicted of a crime, in which case you don't get to vote, you can't get jobs in which are, you know, high paying and esteemed, if you will. I'm sorry if that was prejudice. But in terms of why is there not a community center, why is there not, you know, tutoring places and et cetera, et cetera. I think it goes back, rewinding from the prison system to Jim Crow to segregation to slavery to, you know, stealing people, which is disgusting. And I want to cry about it, especially like right now in this climate. Like, I'm not always emotional over slavery, but I have been in the last several months because people are acting like it was nothing. People are acting like, and I mean the specific group of people who are kind of negative and bad, but they're simply ignoring 200 years of history to hold up their, you know, their white power, not their white power, but their white status, and make sure that it's not tarnished. Well, I don't think that tarnished for 200 years and it still wouldn't be as bad. That's a big blanket statement. I don't mean it literally, but you know what I mean? Like, white people they got it going on in terms of history. So it's going to be hard for history to mess them up, I think.
Except for
when they do put out that negativity on their own. And I call it like showing your colors, when they, you know, say that, you know, when they defend police officers who have done horrible things, or they say all lives matter in response to Black Lives Matter, that's showing their colors. You know, absolutely. Oh, I got a little reverb from you.
I would love to keep you on a little bit longer, but you told me you only had 30 minutes, so I'm gonna have to bug you to come back on, man, because I enjoy your conversation and I love what you're having to say. You're teaching the next generation, and I appreciate that. You never know how much.
I'd love to anytime.
Well, give us your final thoughts for the evening, and if you have any social media you want people to find out about, fine. If not, just give us your final thoughts for the evening, and I appreciate having you on, Andy.
I'm good on social media. I think I'll leave with a little quote. Be the change you wish to see in the world. Nelson Mandela, I think.
Hey, words of wisdom. I have to look them up, see where they came from. But thank you so much, Andy, and I look forward to talking to you once again.
Thank you very much for calling, and I'm happy to join anytime. Have a great night.
You too.
Bye-bye.
That was Andy, one of the guys from next door. And as I said, he was a teacher, and he's a gentleman that I thought we would have some fun talking to. I believe, let's see, I'm looking down here, and I think I'm going to take a shot here. Is this Mike?
This is Nick.
Nick, okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Okay, no, that's already.
Hey, James.
Already, so how are you doing, my man?
Hey, Gary. I feel bad about our passionate chat this morning. I saw that you left, and I hope I didn't piss you off more than I normally piss you off, but it was, I really do enjoy talking to people I don't see eye to eye with, because I know I have tremendous biases that I need to work on, and I'm a stubborn case. I'm not going to have my mind changed easily, but I'm certainly open to having it changed. And you know, I'm one of your few, I don't know if I would be able to label myself as one of your friends. I'd like to work towards that, but I am definitely one of your few, I think, conservative friends I'd like to be, if I'm not. And, you know, I want to give the conservative side the Republican side, if you will, even though it's almost an epithet at this point, of a lot of these very complex issues, because I feel like my side is just being ridiculed and condensed down to a cartoonish simplification where a lot of our thoughts are not being properly understood. And if that's appropriate for me to explain where people like myself are coming from through Black Lives Matter, through socialism, through defending someone as awful as Trump, which I recognize he's a horrible figure, I'd like to have a dialogue.
Well, you know, I don't mind having a dialogue, Nick. As you know, you're the one that actually got me involved with Left versus Right, more or less, with that one day that you asked me to host. But here's where I kind of have a problem with the conservative point of view, and I'm going to ask you to kind of enlighten me, because here's what I see happening, and it goes back to our original conversation, is that everyone wants to say, well, okay, we need solutions, but you want solutions that fit your particular area. And I'm not saying you per se, but you know, when I say you, I'm talking about systemic racism, white privilege. Okay, you've had this privilege the last 400 years, and now all of a sudden, within the last 60-70 years, you have a problem with this asking for equality, which is something that we should not have to ask. I mean, you know, if you understand what I'm saying, it's like you don't have to ask.
Can I respond?
Yes.
So I'm totally with you on equality of opportunity. I want there to be a solution that gives everybody the same opportunity. And I'm with you up until present day, where in the past, no doubt, African-Americans, and not just African-Americans, but Jews, Chinese-Americans, Japanese-Americans, they were all held back through institutional, systemic, either racism or bigotry. I mean, there were quotas on how many Jews could go into medical school. There were Chinese that were put into Japanese were put into internment camps, or Chinese that were heavily oppressed. But I understand where you're coming from, and I think your approach is more, let's redress the past, where African Americans especially, not exclusively, but especially, were subjugated because of national law. There were laws on the books, in Jim Crow especially, that treated blacks differently than whites, and it has taken them hundreds of years to catch up. It might take them hundreds of more. And where you and I diverge, and I hope we can do this at least respectfully without, you know, resorting to calling each other racist or anything like that, is I think giving equal opportunity is enough. But trying to push for equal outcome is an impossible endeavor, because it never exists. I mean, just look at within the white population. You have people from all over the income spectrum. You're never going to have equality within one race, let alone across the board. So don't hold people back. Give them every opportunity they can to succeed. And in some cases, maybe you have to give certain benefits to inner city youths that aren't available to suburban whites. And I'm with you on that as well. But I don't think, and I don't feel that, and I'm not convinced that using the claim of systemic racism to push forth policies that outright favor people of a certain race over the other races is appropriate. And I understand the rationale for it, but it's hard for me to look past the fact that you're perpetuating what could certainly fit the definition of racism for the purpose of combating racism. And if I hadn't made that point clear before, that was the point I was trying to make on the next door threat.
Okay. Now, I hear what you're saying, but let's talk about the country of Israel. Okay.
Sure.
Do you consider Israel's systemic racism?
Well, I think I know where you're going with that. Like, are you asking if Israel uses systemic racism against Palestinians per se?
Right. Right.
I certainly understand the argument in favor of that, to the point where I could make the argument that Israel is an oppressive state, that they subjugate Palestinians, that they don't give them the same rights as Israelis. And I think, is that what you're asking me? If I believe that to be the case.
Right.
So,
what I'm asking more importantly is, do you think that we have handled black lives in America the same way that you've handled Palestinian lives in Israel?
Yeah. So I don't want to answer the question with a question, so let me answer your question. I think we've treated blacks less fairly than Israelis have treated Palestinians. And let me just explain why I say that. So you have to look at context. In every single issue, there's a context that will reframe the entire issue if you eliminate or even alter the context. Now, if you look at Israel and you look at what they've done to separate Palestinians, their mothers from their children, just like in this country, you look at how horrific the images of our Border Patrol, CBP, separating children from their mothers, putting them in cages. On the surface, it looks terrible. However, that is a deliberate misrepresentation of the full context. In Israel, what Israelis were forced to do to deal with incessant suicide bombing was to heavily screen Palestinians. You can't look at it in a vacuum. If the Palestinians had never committed acts of terrorism, and I know this is why the issue will never be solved, because it keeps going back and back. If I talk about Israel responding to Palestinian terrorism, then the logical rebuttal to that will be, well, look at how the Palestinians are oppressed under Israel. Of course they're going to be terrorists. And a lot of it comes down to, you know, is Israel acting with malice and outright hatred of Palestinians, or are they acting with the protection of their own citizens, as every country is entitled and obligated to, in the face of Palestinians? Israel used to allow ambulances to go past the checkpoints, and the PLO and others, Islamic Jihad, realized that they could exploit that exception, so they started using suicide bombers in ambulances. They would pretend that they were injured or actually injure them. They would get through the checkpoint, and then they would detonate. And it's really unfair to look at just the Israeli response without what the Palestinians did to warrant the response. And then you can talk about whether Israel has gone too far, but to compare it to nothing is not a fair comparison.
Okay, so let's go back here to Black Lives Matter now, okay? So just kind of drawing a parallel, you have Black Lives Matter that essentially started 5 years ago. They were almost considered a terrorist organization, I believe. Now, you know, it's kind of lost that identity, but a lot of people don't want to admit that, just like every other movement, it's revolutionized. Just like I believe I had someone on next Garvey. Well, I'm proud in some ways because I and it's clear. I want to be able to ability to be a brain surgeon, but I want to be able to go to the library to check out a book on it if I want to. I want to be able to go and vote without someone saying, you don't know the third line of the Constitution of the state of Mississippi, I can't vote. And I think that those are the things that we're trying to get to the same page on. But you can't say that, because this happened 400 years ago, that I can't make the playing field level, because you can't. But what you can do is put everyone at the same starting line. That doesn't mean they're all going to finish the race, but you can at least make us all start at the same point.
So tell me why someone, an African-American born today, especially in a suburb, who's from a middle-class African-American family, in a suburb that's predominantly white, like, what is holding that African-American child back? Why is he not starting from a level playing field, like, systemically?
Okay. I'm glad you asked that, because I have some other conservatives, some black friends, I guess consider them friends, that are very black conservative, and they believe into their conservative causes and things like that. But once again, they're privileged. They don't start out with the same playing field that, say, a sixth grader in suburbia does not start out with the same playing field as a sixth grader at a charter school in Chicago. Would you agree with that?
Of course, but wouldn't you also say the same thing if it was a black sixth grader going to a charter school versus a white sixth grader in, Flint, Michigan? I mean, it's more about economics than race, it seems.
Yes, sir. It is more about economics, and that's the problem. Do you think that for instance, I'll give you, we can use Flint, Michigan, since you brought it up. The water in Flint, Michigan is brown. Yet the water in the suburbs, and you can look this up on Facebook and a few other places, the water in the suburbs is clean. So how do you clean water in the white suburbs, but you let it stay brown in the black suburbs? I mean, doesn't that seem to be unequal?
Right. No, of course it's unequal. And look who's running, the government there. Look at the politicians. I mean, I'm a conservative at heart go ahead.
Who was the governor of Michigan, and who was the mayor of Flint when this crisis first started? They were conservatives.
Yeah, I mean, I think conservatives can make terrible politicians as well. Absolutely. And I don't trust the government to protect us. I mean, you were in the military, and I can imagine how you feel about certain elements of our government. They should not be your first line of defense. Now, there's no excuse for the unsat water. Do you realize that on some of the military bases, there's unsat water, not to mention black mold? And these are active duty Marines in California. So, it's terrible. And it has to be. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you know what I'm talking about.
Yes, I do. I can tell you stories about VA hospitals back east, as compared to the ones out here in the West. I got a lot of horror stories for you.
Without going on a tangent, I mean, it's just the VA hospital, to me, shows me what government-run healthcare would look like, and I am highly unimpressed. I mean, I dealt with the VA after my deployment, absolute incompetence. This was in 2014. They've gotten better since then, but I don't trust the government with my health care, and I'm willing to pay far more out of pocket than to get free government care. I mean, these are the people that run the DMV. These are the people that let our roads just absolutely crumble, and we're paying record taxes. I know it's a tangent off the point, but the government doesn't really solve problems. The only problem the government can solve are the problems that the government creates. I mean, Jim Crow was essentially state-mandated segregation. And then, you know, the government under the Democrats, which used to be the racist party, gives itself a big pat on the back because now we're suddenly not racist. And it looked to me, when they made their change around the 60s, it was to get loyal black votes. And you've seen the horrible things that, you know, LBJ said, trivializing the black vote, thinking that if they just hand out money and entitlements, they'll get a reliable voting bloc. I mean, that's a horrendous, horribly racist sentiment, to think that you can just group an entire block of people as a singular voting bloc because you give them free stuff. And the Democrats have been pushing to tell us how racist this country has been and always will be, essentially. Whereas, I mean, nobody doubts that this country was racist. It was very similar to other countries in the past that practiced slavery, of which was the status quo back then. And it was the United States, France, and the UK that abolished slavery in the Western Hemisphere. I mean, it was our countries that made it illegal internationally before slavery was made illegal in the United States. So, I mean, we have to take a balanced look. It's not appropriate to use modern-day sentiments as to the horrors of slavery nowadays, which we're all in agreement on, and apply them over 200 years and say they should have known better. They should have thought like we think now. I mean, you can see how you and I, if we eat meat right now, 100 years from now, you and I would look like barbarians as the world starts to go towards vegetarianism. I mean, there's people that are exploiting the Black Lives Matter movement and trying to, you know, latch onto their gains by saying, you know, we should treat meat eaters as if they're racist. We should treat meat eaters like they're smokers, make them eat outside. And that's to illustrate the point of applying, you know, what you think are your common sense, rational approaches to people that don't agree with you. And slavery, again, was widely practiced. And of course, it still is practiced in parts of the Middle East and China. And that is where I think you and I and the two sides could come together and make a difference. I mean, we spend so much time, and I'm not just talking about you and me, but in academia, on the news, talking about slavery in this country, whereas we could actually do something about the slavery that still exists in some of the Middle East countries. And nobody cares about, you know, the Muslims being oppressed in China. Nobody cares about the genital mutilation. I mean, I don't understand why we just go back and forth and tear each other down. And it's so vitriolic. And I felt horrible after the chat this morning when you left because I thought that, you know, I offended you. And I definitely could have dealt with it more calmly, but I think we both got worked up. And you know, I'm glad you gave me a second chance to talk to you now.
So I'm not easily offended, but sometimes when I know, you know, I mean, when I have to use certain anger management, and I find myself sometimes, rather than get myself drawn off into a tangent where I don't want to, you know, it's easy for me to leave and come back. Which is one of the things that, yeah, that I really hate about our conversations, our Zoom meetings, is because I don't think you can get enough points in 30 minutes. If a good conversation starts, you're talking about a good 5 or 10 minutes. So, you know, I mean, in that sense, you know, I sometimes remove myself. But you asked a question this morning, and I think maybe I did get a little overbearing because I think everybody is asking for solutions. But I've been asking for solutions for a long time. Everybody wants to tell me, well, we should do this, we should do that. Well, why haven't we done it? And when you talk about, you know, when you talk about an equal playing field, if you've ever been and I'm sure you have, especially, I mean, you know, Army, Navy, game, whatever. But, you know, if you watch track, you have staggered starts. And that's the reason why you have them, so that everyone can have an equal playing field. Why can't we do the same thing, fight, instead of saying, well, you know, I understand that happened to you 200 years ago, but, you know, well, you know, let's move on from here. Well, we can't move on until we find that common ground that we're going to move from.
Yeah.
Am I going to
move
from?
Well, James, when I'm asking for solutions, like, this is where I'm trying to meet you in the middle. It's like, what I'm trying to ask is, so, you know, we can't change what has happened in the past. That's already done. But when I ask for a solution, what I'm asking you is, where do we go from here? Like, how do we move forward? We can't change what has happened. We can only control the actions we take going forward. And that's all I'm asking for. I'm not asking it disingenuously. It's not a gotcha. I just want to wonder, like, how do we get past this mire that we're stuck in? Because we can't handle 4 more years of this. We can't handle 200 more years of this. There'll be no country left. I mean, look how terrible it is, how divisive we are, how people are trying to cancel each other professionally. And the scary thing is that, you know, you might be on the right side of the mob today, but there's no guarantee they won't look at something you said in the past and decide that, you know, you or your family has to be punished. People that never did anything, like maybe if you have a spouse, your kids, they have to be doxxed and their address posted online. I mean, this is a terrible, terrible time in our history where we are just tearing each other apart. And I worry that our known enemies, namely China and to a lesser extent Russia, are just relishing the fact that we are melting down from within. And as you've seen, because I know you follow global politics, like, China is exploiting this to their gain with the South China Sea, with their suppression of Hong Kong. They know that we are too distracted to really come together in any kind of solid front. So they're completely exploiting our distraction. They're also teaming up with Russia. And if we keep at this, you know, we will be soon overtaken by one, if not both, of the countries. And the way we know it, I mean, it sounds overstated, but I mean, China is going to have such a stranglehold on so many aspects that people had no idea we were so vulnerable to until this year. We saw just PPE and pharmaceuticals, how vulnerable we were to China. They have so much more control over that, along with electronics. And we have to stop the endless fighting. We have to figure out what is a mutually agreeable solution that works for the African American community, that addresses the instances of police using excessive force. Because I recognize that conservatives in general will defend the police more, and I recognize that we have to do a better job of recognizing that there are instances where the police have certainly overstepped. And there were cases where, you know, black suspects literally did nothing wrong and were shot. But the other side also has to recognize that those are the exception. It's not the norm that cops go looking for black people and shoot them for no reason. And that's an easy narrative to portray when you focus on selective incidents. But you have to put it, again, into context as to, is this more likely to happen or less likely to happen? And that's probably where you and I disagree. But what I want is just a solution that could work for both. It's going to be a compromise. There's no way your side is going to get everything. There's no way conservatives are going to get everything they want. But something that meets them in the middle is all I ask.
But once again, you're asking for an equal finish. I want an equal start, and I think that's where we have our greatest diversity. You're looking for the end game, and I want to be able to say, okay, Nick, you and I, you know, I think we've had this discussion before. You and I sit in the waiting room. You know, employer comes in. I want to say, you know, hey, you know, you and I have the same education, the same qualifications. I want to say that we have an equal playing field. But if you're over, I'll even kind of bring it down to a
a personal level. When I lived in New Jersey and in New York, a lot of the people that I dealt with were Hasidics. And as you know, Hasidics are really big in the diamond and jewelry business. Oh, yeah. And even they closed off other, I don't know what you call it, sects, other different Jewish
right,
sects.
Yeah, there's, I mean, I'm not a practicing Jew. I'm not religious at all, but I understand the culture well enough. I mean, I had my bar mitzvah. There's Reform Judaism. So, there's, and they treat you the same they would treat me. They look down upon people like myself who've given up on their faith. They look down on Reform Jews, and they're very insular. It's like a clique, and you're either in or you're out.
Right. And that's the way I kind of feel that conservatives treat and don't get me wrong, it's not just conservatives, because I've had the same thing, the same conversation with liberals and Democrats. I think that everyone takes the black vote for granted, and you throw us a few crumbs at election time. And, 2 years, we forget about it. And then we have this conversation all over again when it comes time to elect a president.
So let me ask you this. Like, I wanted to ask you, and I didn't feel comfortable asking this because I know it's divisive, but J.C. Jackson and Al Sharpton, do you think they genuinely are doing things to help black people? Or do you think they are keeping race relations very tense because it's extremely profitable for the organizations and thus for them? I mean, do you think they would want racial harmony in this country?
Okay, let me address. I know you said Al Sharpton was one. Who was the other one that you asked about?
Jesse Jackson.
Yeah. Oh, wow. You picked probably my least favorite person, and then and then the one that I'm kind of skeptical of. And I'll start with my least favorite person first, and that's Jesse Jackson. Because I believe that Jesse Jackson has exploited black people ever since the death of Martin Luther King. I think he's one of those relics of the past that people of my generation, espouse to because of his relationship with Dr. Martin Luther King. Not because of anything that he's done independently, but because of past association. Now, Al Sharpton. Al Sharpton, when he first came out, I thought, I used to actually substitute Al Sharpton for Al Charlatan. Okay? So that's how that's how my relationship with Al Sharpton started out. Now, present day, I think Al has become more aligned with what's happening in the neighborhood. I thought that Al was kind of one of those guys that wanted to be important in the black community, like Jesse Jackson, wearing the $10,000 suits and spouting out the word, making sure that he was that he had his face in every camera that was available. So I definitely thought that both of those gentlemen were sellouts. As a matter of fact, Jesse Jackson, like I said, with all of the rhetoric, with very little words. Al Sharpton and I have actually become more of a fan of, because I think as he's grown older probably had a few brushes, I'll say, with his maker, and realizing that what type of legacy am I going to really leave within the black community. I think Al has kind of come underneath the banner. Jesse Jackson, I still have very little. I think he's, I guess,
the proper word to me would be bureaucrat. Oh, I've lost Nick. Okay, maybe he'll call back in. But I do think that a lot of conservatives a solution that makes them feel comfortable. They don't want to, you know, what about the 200 or so years that the black community has felt uncomfortable? And there is no comfortable solution. I'm not calling for any type of armed insurrection. I thought what the NFAC did, I thought that was very cool, because I thought it's high time that we stop, letting people just stand on our necks, letting people know that, the Second Amendment applies to everyone. I don't want to see an armed insurrection at all. I don't want to see this country in a civil war. But I think we need to recognize that everyone has the same rights. Whether you want to go along with them or not, don't give me that about, good people on both sides. No, that's bullshit. It's not a good person that wants to have my body decorate a tree. It's not a good person that wants to suppress my right to vote. It's not a good person that runs into a crowd of people just because they're not on the same page or they're not the same color. I find myself getting into a lot of the same arguments with people. And a lot of it, I think, is just because I've lived so long. I've lived to see history repeat itself. And it's not something that I really want to have to go through again. I was appalled and very, very afraid when we had the riots out here in California. Well, not just California, Milwaukee, Louisville, New York City. It was like the 60s all over again. I don't want to see the cities burn. I don't want us having to be under lockdown 24/7. That's not what America is about. But when you have a leadership that is aimless and gives you no direction, I'll take this a step further, talking about COVID-19. A lot of people say that I'm very harsh on 45. But as far as I'm concerned, this man has murdered. Yeah, and that's the word I use. He has murdered over 146,000 Americans. Let me get that. Let's rewind that. Over 100. Let me turn on CNN here. I'm sure I can get the proper figure. I think it's 146,000 and counting. If this man was a military leader and he lost 156 people in combat, he would be considered incompetent. He would be in Fort Leavenworth. He would be drummed out of the military. And yet, we still have to call him Commander-in-Chief. This man is touted a drug that any man that has been in the military, if he has had to go overseas, we've had to take this within the last 60 years. I know it was used extensively for most of the Vietnam War. Nick, I see you back. Nick, I lost you for a minute.
I assure you it wasn't that I hung up because I was so offended at what you were saying about my best friend, Al Sharpton. It was just a bad spot, and I really was intrigued at what you were saying. Is this going to be available to listen afterwards, the blog talk?
Yes. I'll send you the link, and you can listen to it at your leisure. Nick, getting back to some of the things that we don't seem to see eye to eye on.
Right.
You've been in the have you been deployed overseas?
I have.
Did you take hydroxychloroquine?
I don't recall taking hydroxychloroquine. It took like a Z-pack, and I don't recall taking hydroxychloroquine. I remember hearing that one of the drugs had a side effect of hallucinations, and I don't know if that was hydroxychloroquine, because the reason they wouldn't give it to us was because of the hallucinations, and I guess they had...
That was it. That was it.
Okay, so then, because it was an anti-malarial. I got deployed to the Horn of Africa in Djibouti, and it was something else that they gave me. But, I'm glad you brought that up. And I only have about 15 more minutes. I got to get back. But I am fascinated by this give and take on hydroxychloroquine, where it was very promising, and then Trump got behind it, and then it was just the deadliest thing ever. And then the Lancet study came out, and almost all of my friends, because almost all my friends are very liberal, I really don't have any conservative friends, maybe it's because I live in California, they were just overjoyed that the Lancet study showed that hydroxychloroquine was causing heart attacks, and it seemed to vindicate everything they were saying and invalidate everything Trump was saying. And then they got it wrong. And then the Lancet study turned out to be a total fraud, and they had to retract it. And I don't think that's ever happened in the Lancet's history. But that makes me wonder, why is there such a push to go against everything that Trump says? I mean, I understand why, but, I mean, something that should be so apolitical as a treatment to the coronavirus, which itself should be apolitical, everything about it is becoming a gotcha. And hydroxychloroquine does have incredible potential. I assume you saw the African female doctor that spoke recently, all the videos that kept getting pulled, but she was basically saying hydroxychloroquine, zinc, and Z-Pak has been curing all of her patients of COVID. All of them survived except one. And that, to me, go ahead.
She also suggested that we're inseminated by aliens while we're sleeping.
Yeah, she had to just go and ruin a perfectly good argument. She blew it.
The reason why I asked you about hydroxy in particular was because you were in the military, and if you had taken it, you would know why most GIs are dead set against it, because of the side effects, and because you cannot function. If by some chance, the Tet offensive, and you're still under the effects of hydroxy, it's not going to work. You might
because of the hallucinations.
Right, because of the hallucinations, that might bring about paranoia.
Wouldn't one solution be to administer hydroxychloroquine, and then there's going to be a mandatory 2-week quarantine for most people, as there should be. And during that time, that's when they have the hallucinations. That's when they can get out the crazies. And they're doing both. They're getting out the hallucinations and they're treating their coronavirus. After 2 weeks, if they show no coronavirus and they show no hallucinations, then I would consider that a success.
Yeah, but I'm 73 years old, Nick. Do I really want to play Russian roulette with hydroxychloroquine?
No, you don't. Everything is a compromise. Everything's a risk. And no, you don't want to. You want to do whatever is in your best interest. And yes, there's risk to hydroxychloroquine, but there probably is a greater risk of not taking it. I mean, there's a huge risk of going on a ventilator. The prognosis for that is very dire, and that's something that they've learned from the beginning when they thought the ventilators were the ticket, and Cuomo was asking for 40,000. And then they realized an oxygen, essentially it's like an oxygen hood, was far more effective. And then turning yourself on your side is effective. I mean, the thing that concerns me is that we're kind of shortcutting the scientific method, is that every potential treatment should be looked at unbiased and critically and not be subjected to the overwhelming political pressure, which seems to surround hydroxychloroquine more than any other treatment.
I understand what you're saying, but I also, like I said, you know, I would be willing to bet that if you interviewed 10,000 surviving Vietnam veterans, 10,000 Iraqi veterans that have actually taken the drug, they would actually tell you that, you know, the side effects, you know, and especially for something that's a 50-50 shot. Let's talk about a couple other things that I think
we
should talk about.
Real quick, I got 5 more minutes, and then I'm going to have to go. So,
okay.
I'm really enjoying this chat, by the way.
The stimulus package, do you think that we should have another one? And if so, why? If not, why?
Sure. So I haven't. And if you have the study, I mean, just because I haven't seen something doesn't mean it doesn't exist. I haven't seen the clear correlation between countries that shut everything down and countries that were responsible in how they shut down certain sectors. They quarantined the sick, the vulnerable, the elderly, and then they had the rest of the country to full employment. Not quite. You know, Sweden is one. That's probably the most pronounced. But countries throughout the world have had all kinds of different responses to coronavirus. And there doesn't seem to be a standout trend that countries who locked everything down, even countries who mandated masks, had a noticeably and statistically significant increase in the prognosis or decrease in the mortality. I'm not talking about cases. I'm talking about the mortality rate. So I don't agree that our country still should be shut down to the extent it is, just widespread. Certain sectors, perhaps. I don't believe that the schools, especially for the younger grades, should be shut down. So my first preference would be to reopen the economy so people can go back to work, so they don't need, you know, another infusion of, we know how many trillions it's going to be. It's going to be probably $1 to $4 trillion more. And this is unsustainable. This is breaking our country. And I don't have kids, so I don't feel, you know, personally like I'm giving a hardship to my kids. I feel personally devastated about all of my neighbors and their kids who are going to be saddled with a debt that they will never repay in their generation, which might have devastating consequences for their futures. They're not probably going to exceed the level of wealth that their parents had. Many in my generation will never own a home. So I know it's getting off track, and I should answer your question respectfully and directly. So I don't want there to be another stimulus, but if they're going to insist on keeping the economy shut down, then there's no choice. People have to have money to pay their rent, pay their food. You know, I'm an attorney, and I feel just as bad for my landlord clients as I do their tenants. Most people want to go back to work. Now, I can agree with you that we need to have a stimulus if we're not going to reopen the economy. But would you agree with me that there needs to be some kind of incentive for people to go back to work if they can and not get paid more to not work than they get paid to work, which has been the case? People getting paid more not to work.
I wholeheartedly agree with you, but when you figure that most of the families that are dependent upon this money are either in the service or the hospitality industry, you have to remember a lot of these people aren't going to come. They're not going to have their jobs back, Nick. I mean, you know, I don't know very many restaurants. Being a former chef, I don't know anyone that can open their restaurant at 50% capacity and expect to make money. That just doesn't happen.
No, I'm with you. I mean, I love the fact that restaurants, and this is the American spirit. I mean, one of the reasons why this is the best country, and I think it's okay to have nationalism, not white nationalism, just nationalism, is that Americans are incredibly resilient and they will adapt. And what you're seeing all over San Diego, I assume you live in San Diego, is restaurants converting their parking lots. They're converting street parking to outdoor dining, and it's working. I mean, they're staying afloat for now. This isn't going to be forever. But what needs to change is the mandate. It's irresponsible for them, for the government, to keep changing the goal. Remember, all it was supposed to be flatten the curve. And nobody ever said, you know, the goal is to avoid getting this. The goal was to prevent the hospitals from being overwhelmed. And as long as that's not happening, I know we're close, and I know the news can't wait to tell us all the areas where the ICUs are at 90% capacity. However, as long as the hospitals have room, we should allow people to go about their business, because how else are we going to get past this? You have to get coronavirus. You have to get the disease and get the immunity. There's no way you're going to forever shield yourself with a little paper mask that's almost a placebo. It gives people a false sense of security.
Okay. I know you said you had to go, Nick, so I'm going to let you why don't you get your final word off here, and hey, man, anytime you want to come back on, I have no problem discussing with you. Believe me.
No, this is great. So, I mean, I think I was listening to when you were speaking to the teacher earlier, and, you know, there's no shortage of leftist viewpoints. I don't mean that in a derogatory manner. It's just there's no shortage of the left of center view, because that's where you get – I mean, you get it everywhere you listen and look. Every time I turn on the news, it's, well, Trump did this. It's so easy to focus on the mistakes of Trump, and he's a – terrible speaker. He's probably a terrible person, but his policies are aligned with my priorities, and that's how I can, you know, hold my nose and vote for him again. If you can show me, if any of your listeners, your friends, your far left counterparts can show me a candidate who A, recognizes the threat that China is to our country, and B, recognizes the risk of both parties just spending trillions as if they're single dollars, just printing out money from the Fed and Treasury. You show me a fiscally responsible conservative who values our national security, who puts Americans first, not the needs of the rest of the world, like I felt Obama did repeatedly, President Obama. I'll vote for him. I'll vote for him over Trump. But Trump is the best bad option, and that's totally understandable how it's easy to ridicule Republicans. And the reason why I want to have a dialogue with people like you is you and I, every time we talk, maybe notwithstanding today's chat this morning, you and I come away understanding each other just a little bit better, realizing that, you know, we both are a little more human than we appear to be through text online. And we actually agree a lot more and on a lot more issues than we would otherwise know once we actually have a chance to have a respectful civil discussion. So I hope we can continue these. I know there's going to be moments that get tense at times. I just hope we can avoid personal attacks and keep it civil, keep it insightful, and keep broadening our perspectives.
Yeah, like I said, I think we need time to talk about things, because when you try to put everything into 10 seconds or one, you're a little overpassionate. But you know, I'm willing to talk to anyone. I don't mind talking. And, you know, I'm kind of like you. You know, if you can show me, you know, I'm not from Missouri, but if you can show me a different point of view, I'm willing to explore.
Yeah.
I might not accept it, but I'm willing to explore.
Sure.
And Nick, I think I really would like you to read that book, Brainwashed. I think we could have a little different perspective. And I'll tell you what, if you read that one, you can send me a title and I'll read one of your conservative books.
That's exactly what I was going to ask. That's okay. That's totally fair. That sounds like a deal. Oh, it's just going to be so hard for me to choose just one.
We'll start with one and we'll go from there. But thank you so much for coming on tonight, man. Appreciate your time and
likewise.
Look forward to talking.
Thanks, man. Talk to you later.
Yeah. That was Nick, and I'm sure a lot of you people that have been on Nextdoor have seen a lot of the conversations that we've had. It's really gotten very heated, and I think it's both because we look at it from somewhat of a veteran's point of view. And I know the oath that I took to this country, Donald Trump, is the epitome of evil. I've had some personal dealings, so that might have a lot to do with my personal prejudices. But I really wanted to talk to we had Mike. I was hoping that Mike would be able to come on the show tonight. Hopefully, we'll be able to get him on next week, along with a couple of young ladies. I would like to get one of the members of the Black Panther Party here in San Diego. I've talked with some of the Huey Newton Gun Club organizers. I'm also reaching out to the NFAC, and hopefully we can get one of their representatives here on the show. But I want to thank everyone for taking the time tonight to give me a listen. I hope some of the views of our guests help enlighten you. I hope they had some impact and gives you some food for thought. That's what the political consciousness of West Coast Steelers Fan is all about. Thank you, Andy. Thank you, Nick. To all my listeners, and I look forward once again to talking to you next Monday, right here on the Political Consciousness of West Coast Steelers Fan. Have a great night, everyone. We'll talk to you next week.